Hello, and welcome to the Influence Change at Work show. I'm your host, Heather Stagel, founder and change facilitator at Enclaria, where you can accelerate your influence and overcome obstacles to change so you can make a bigger impact in your workplace. Today, my guest is Lena Ross, who is here to talk about how change is changing. Since establishing her Melbourne, Australia-based consulting practice, Change Hacks, in 2016, Lena runs workshops and consults to senior leadership teams on building agile capability. Lena's work draws on the latest thinking in change management from areas such as design thinking, future of work, digital, and agile mindset and approaches. She is also the co-founder of the Agile Change Leadership Institute, which was founded with Dr. Jen Fromm, who's been on the show before. Lena has authored two books, Hacking for Agile Change, and also her latest book, Change Management: The Essentials, was just released. Lena, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for that great introduction too.
Now, your new book, Change Management and the Essentials, you share a lot of practical exercises and templates for how to do the work of change management. And I was excited to read through it and see how you do things. You know, it's always interesting to see how everyone does things differently. But the part of the book that caught my attention was about how change is changing when you talk about that at the end of the book. So I thought we might talk about that here today.
Sure.
Well, why don't we start where all changes start, which is with the current state. And so I'm curious, you know, where are we at right now with change management? Or maybe we're already in the future. Maybe we're talking about the past. But where are we now?
So to kind of have a view of where we are now, Heather, we're kind of on caught between two worlds where we know we're not in a stable state anymore, but there's a lot of change practitioners, I guess, still anchored to a lot of processes and methodologies that do cater for planned change rather than responsive change. And we're in that state at the moment with what's going on worldwide, and I'll talk about that a little bit more, where, you know, it's not so stable and we do need to change the way we change. But having said that, so if we've come from a stable state, I guess even as recently as 7 or 8 years ago when I was working in change and in the process of helping set up enterprise change practices in organizations, the ethos at the time was very much around having change frameworks which were consistent in times of relative stability, where you would do things one way, same way across the organization. And this one way, same way seemed to be a little bit of a hangover from total quality management in those days. And it was a way to define the change practitioner or the change management value proposition to the organization. But what, of course, we're seeing now is we're moving into times that are a lot less stable. We need to be more responsive. Change is probably less planned and more responsive and iterative. And that paradigm of, you know, change and then refreeze or unfreeze and then refreeze, that refreeze state doesn't really exist anymore. That's static in itself. It's more about adopt, adapt and evolve and keep iterating. So that comfort that we once had is now forcing us to think differently because we don't have that anymore.
Yeah, I've always felt like that concept of refreezing means that you really have to be careful because if you refreeze it too much, it just creates a new status quo that you have to try to break.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I even know, like, people are still asking me to help them design change frameworks. And while we know that, you know, it's probably better to go to a more adaptive change delivery approach, instead of, you know, the old, you know, embed and institutionalize the change and that sort of thinking is really now more about let's just land the change and then think about evolving and iterating and adapting as we go. So just really shifting the mindset a little bit that it's not just, oh, we've put the change, we've landed the change in now, phew, now we can relax for a little while and worry about the next change when it comes. It's just not like that anymore. So that's the state we're in now. It's that constant change rather than really planned, land, then relax a little bit and then wait maybe for the next wave to come along.
Right. And I've seen articles out there that say that change management is dead. Do you think that's true?
No. It's funny you say that because that's exactly one of the things I spoke about at the book launch last week. I did a Google search to on change management is dead. And when you do it properly with the inverted commas, you get more than 30,000 results on that. And I said to the audience, don't be alarmed. I think we can talk about change is changing rather than change management is dead. But I can understand why some of those, some of that thinking comes about with the fact that change is the new normal. And I think it's because people are thinking of change the way we've done it in times of stability as planned change with, you know, reliable frameworks and step-by-step processes. And now what we're seeing is a very agile world, a very different place. And it's about change is changing rather than what we did. Maybe what we used to do, there's parts of that that we may need to retire, but definitely I wouldn't say change management as an occupation in itself or a discipline is dead. I would like to reframe it to change is changing.
Well, that's a relief.
I know. I always like the positive spin as well.
So let's dig a little bit more into what's happening in the world of business that's causing change to change.
Sure. So at the macro level, if you look at there's the VUCA environment, and I know VUCA's been an overused word for volatility, uncertainty, complexity and ambiguity, but you've got a VUCA environment where disruptors are disrupting disruptors. So you've got second and third generation disruptors. For example, you would have had CDs disrupting cassettes, and then you had MP3 disrupting CDs, and then you had Apple Music and then Spotify, and now we've got software as subscription services disrupting a lot of old, more stable models. So that calls for an environment where change is a lot more responsive now and people need to adapt and be very nimble in their organisations. You've got, in that VUCA environment, you've got black swan events, like these events that have high impact that are unpredictable, like the current issue with the pandemic and the coronavirus, that are calling for responsive change. And the VUCA environment really intensifies an event like that because we are globalized. We can move around very quickly. We can communicate. I mean, you and I are communicating in real time now from opposite parts of the globe. So it's, you know, the technology has enabled that as well. So you've got that as the backdrop for change. And the other thing that's really interesting that plays out and impacts organizations is the notion of new power. So once, while power was very much defined by your status or your title or how affluent you were, now with social media and people being able to acquire social capital and connecting, and again with the digitization and globalization, power is now more peer driven and independent of title and money. And that plays out in organizations too, where you need to look for these hidden influences, people who have that social capital and hold that new power, rather than just engaging with people who have a title who may have formal influence. There's a lot of informal influences out there now that are able to leverage that wave of new power. So I would say that's really the backdrop that is creating a very different stage, if you like, for change practitioners and organizations, of course.
Okay, so we assume that change is changing, and so, or the world around us is changing, and so change needs to change. So I need to know, you know, how do we actually adapt our approach to change so that we can keep up?
Yeah, so there's a few things that I do talk about adapting our approach to change. One of them, if we think about new power, one of them was about engaging differently. And I talk about, instead of the traditional top-down engagement that we have used, where we've engaged senior stakeholders and used a very cascaded approach, if you like, in our communications and engagement models, is now to start thinking differently about how we co-create change rather than having a top-down approach, and leveraging those people with social capital who are playing to new power very, very well. So that involves things like enterprise social networks, using processes like Lean Coffee and Working Out Loud, and design thinking processes as well that are very, very user-centric. So that's a little bit of a different approach one can take. So I talk about that being, you know, less top-down and more co-created as one aspect to integrate into our approach. Another one is you know, our change now is less planned and more iterative, as we spoke about, with being adaptively able to deliver in environments like the ones we're in now, with things, very unexpected things happening, which force us to think very differently and think in a very agile way, just not just us as change practitioners, but also organisations. This kind of gets us thinking about the range of tools that we can draw on rather than just a set one way, same way. So I talk about fit for purpose, and I use this metaphor, Heather, about the sushi train. I don't know if you have sushi trains over there. Do you have restaurants where you've got like food coming around like on a little train? Typically, yes. So the Japanese model of a sushi train, where your food comes around on a conveyor belt and you grab what you want when you need it, what you actually feel like eating at that particular point in time. And I say to change practitioners, all your little tools and that you've got from a range of practices like design thinking, lean, agile, DevOps, you know, brain science, org development, think of those as things on your conveyor belt, and then think about what you need now for this particular change rather than just ticking the box and delivering a whole raft of artifacts that may or may not add value. So that's that real fit for purpose. So less planned and more iterative. Also, I talk to change practitioners about considering empathy as well as engagement. So empathy involves taking a really user-centric approach and drawing on practices from design thinking, such as a journey map, for example. So a journey map explores what people are doing, but also what they're thinking and feeling. So by doing the thinking and feeling, you open up the pathway to empathy and those empathetic conversations, because you're providing a safe place for people to talk about feelings and thoughts, which may have not been a forum that was, it may not have even been acceptable to talk about how people were feeling in some organizations, or even safe, because there wasn't a framework or a forum to actually do that. But design thinking as a practice gives us tools that we can integrate now as change practitioners to really open those brave conversations and involve people in a co-created approach. And the other one that I say is we're becoming less practitioner, more advisor, as we're demonstrating that we can draw on a range of these toolkits and really adaptively deliver our change. We're going to signal to our stakeholders and leaders in organisations that we're more like a change business partner or a change advisor rather than a process-centric practitioner by really taking that human-centred approach. So that's where I see it heading. I mean, I've summarised it. I've got 5 points in my book that I can recap, if you like, towards the end or now, but that's pretty much where I think it's doing and where it's going and how we can adapt our approach for that.
Okay. So you mentioned journey maps. So I was wondering if you can talk a little bit more about what that is and how do you create one of those?
Yeah, sure. So a journey map is a design thinking tool. And what it does is it maps a user experience end to end. So, for example, if it was an external customer, for example, catching public transport, it could start from the customer leaving their house until they reach their destination. And it maps that from all touch points across. Now, as organizations are becoming more user-centric and there's a stronger focus now on the employee experience as well as the customer experience, we're using these tools now more for employees. So an employee journey map, one would use to map a current state. So it could be a current state process. For example, it could be accessing an application online. So what the user experience is like from log on, for example, to the end of the experience, like logging off. And what you map end to end is what they're actually doing and then what they may be thinking and feeling. So there's three swim lanes. If you can visualize this as a map, there's three swim lanes that run across that end to end. And then what that helps us do is look for the opportunities for improvement. And if you do that with your end users, you really gather some amazing insights on what they're thinking and feeling while they're doing existing things. And if you use the journey map then to map a future state, that what it might look like when you implement the change to that same process. So you have the future overlay then they will tell you what they want to be thinking and feeling while they're doing it. So you grab some really good insights as to what the future pain points might be, as well as to what some of the past pain or the existing pain points are to improve. Because quite often we implement change, we don't really consult the end user, and then we think, oh, well, we should have seen that coming, that this was going to be a pain point for them, or this is a pain point that we didn't address from the current state that we could have. So it's a very, very powerful tool for a couple of things: uncovering insights, co-creation, and really planning a future state with someone and engaging someone in the future state and getting them thinking about what it's going to look like for them.
Great. Thank you. Thank you.
It's a bit hard to explain when we don't have the picture, but we can make the picture available perhaps.
Okay, yeah, I can add that to the blog when I post the podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something else you mentioned was that the change agent as an advisor versus the one who's doing all the change management, I guess.
Yes.
So I wonder if we can dive into that a little bit more. That seems like the organizations that are developing capability for change are going to be doing a lot better than the people who are just hiring for people to do the change management work. Yes. So I was curious what your take is on that.
Yeah, that is an interesting one. Whilst I see that as a trend emerging in organizations that have perhaps more permanent change managers, it's a real call to action for change practitioners who consult, because it means that going in and making a quick impact is quite imperative if you can. And I say to change practitioners, there's two sides to this, Heather. If you're a permanent employee, you can build relationships and you can really start to demonstrate your value as an advisor versus the practitioner. And you can do that by building relationships and really signaling that you're shifting towards a more adaptive approach. When you're a consultant going into an organization, you do need to do it very, very quickly. It's like a speed date almost. But I say to practitioners, never underestimate your ability to influence through modeling specific practices or behaviors. I mean, we're hardwired to mimic other people, so we can do it. And one example I have is I went into an organization for a very short piece of work to introduce or to help them build out a change framework that was a little more agile in its approach and would start to introduce their practitioners to agile practices. So what I did was I ran some lean coffees and working out loud to gauge feedback, not only from the change practitioners, but also from the impacted users, the people in the organization who are the receivers of the change. So I worked with receivers and initiators. And by doing, for example, lean coffee and introducing a practice like lean coffee, that in itself sparked an interest in like, oh, could we run something like this for something we're doing? Yes, of course you can. Like, this is a great practice that you can implement, replicate, and this is what it does. So they actually saw it in action. So modeling that was really good, and modeling working out loud was something that generated a lot of interest. People wanting to do that, they could see the value in it. They could see how they were just hopping along to sessions that I was running. They could drop in and out, see what I was working on, and contribute and co-create at the same time. So I found there are little things you can do even when you're in an organization for a short space of time to make a lasting impact.
Great. So for people who are listening, who are those change practitioners usually, who are trying to implement something in their organizations, what would you say are the capabilities they need to develop to thrive in this new environment?
As far as capabilities or things that you can learn, there's the learned capabilities, and then there's a mindset shift as well. I would say try and become more familiar with design thinking if you're not already, because they're great practices. And these agile practices such as running lean coffees or working out loud or really leveraging enterprise social networks. So they're really great tools for communicating with co-creation in mind rather than communicating for the purpose of communicating. Things like nudge, you know, behavioral economics, brain science, they're all great to know from a behavioral perspective. And I say to people, really, your mindset and your learning mindset really becomes your new superpower. So I say to people, your superpower is your ability to learn fast and learn iteratively. So about testing and learning rather than learning and going and sitting in a classroom, really more about self-directed learning. and then testing. So in the testing piece comes really experimenting bravely and looking for those safe spaces where you can experiment. And when change practitioners say to me, oh, but I don't want to experiment in case I fail, or I don't want to experiment in case my work's not, you know, really perfect, it's, I say to them, it's about the way you frame it. It's about managing expectations. So if you say to your stakeholders, I'm experimenting with this, I'm not clear on what the outcome might be, but let's do this together and let's see what works. You're framing things in a very different way to delivering an artifact that has, or used to have, an expectation around it that was, it was pretty perfect by the time it was going to be delivered, rather than doing things iteratively now that may not be so perfect, and more at the experimenting approach. And the other thing I say to them is be courageously curious. That's going to be part of your learning mindset, that's really going to help you through times of uncertainty and ambiguity, and just being brave enough to ask those questions. And they're the kind of superpowers I think we need now in this world of such high complexity and ambiguity.
Definitely. Can you talk a little bit more about how you use enterprise social networks for communication?
Yes. So enterprise social networks I've had most experience with Yammer and Slack. I know in organizations they are probably the most common, but there's a lot more out there. But the principles are pretty much the same. I've used enterprise social networks to work out loud, so to talk about what I'm working on, and gauge feedback perhaps. I've used enterprise social networks to test ideas on things that I haven't even tried yet. I've used enterprise social networks to even run little pulse surveys. So in change readiness, when you've got a lot of time in change readiness, particularly maybe more with planned change, you can run a lot of change readiness surveys to gauge where people are at. If you don't have a lot of time, you can do very quick pulse checks on the day, like how did you find the new system that we've landed today, tell us some of your pain points, or they can just be little quick surveys like, you know, give us out of five how you're tracking. So you can use them to really engage. When I use enterprise social networks, I use a couple of tricks. I try and tap into the influencers who are on enterprise social networks to seek their opinion so they can weigh in, because then it starts to really amplify what's going on. I hashtag a lot, because then it becomes like a knowledge management system. If people want to hashtag a particular topic, they can find a topic really easily. Some of this is very basic to people who are experienced on social media, but they're really handy tips for people who are new on social. And the other thing I try and do is really get the leaders on board to model the behaviours and to model that enterprise social networking is okay, and it does open up a path for two-way communication. So if a leader says to me, can you draft my post for social media, I go, I can, but it might be better if you draft it, because it's your authentic voice, and it's okay to be authentic and demonstrate a little bit of vulnerability if that is what you're going to do as well.
Always good to have leaders on board, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's summarize this. You mentioned earlier you could summarize some points.
So, sure.
What do people need to know about how change is changing?
I guess what it means for us is, I've got in my book, I've got five things about what it means for change practitioners. I would say, think about, and this isn't a dichotomy, this isn't about not doing one thing and only doing the other. It's just a shift about less planned change, more iterative change that I spoke about. Which means, you know, the sushi train, and really doing right sizing your change so you're adaptively delivering what you need at that point in time. Less top-down engagement and more co-created engagement, using things like enterprise social networks and those examples around lean coffee and working out loud. Looking at really bringing empathy into your engagement, so less about just engagement, more about tapping into empathy and using those design thinking tools such as the journey map that we explored, less about just a list of artifacts and more about experiments, and framing a lot of your work as experiments to manage stakeholder expectations, so then you're on this in this together and you can iterate together and explore it together, and less straight change practitioner and more change advisor. So they would be the five things, I think, where we could start to see a lot of how change is changing and the role that we play in helping people, the leaders, deliver that change.
Great. Well, Lena, where can people learn more?
I have a website with a plethora of free resources in the form of white papers, blogs, infographics, and that's lenaross.com.au. And then we also have the Agile Change Institute, which is, it's called the Agile Change Leadership Institute, but the website is agilechangeinstitute.com.au that I co-founded with Dr. Jen Fram. We have a lot of information on there, on particularly on the type of skills that we're teaching people on leading and delivering change in these adaptive environments. I'm on LinkedIn, so hit me up on LinkedIn and connect on LinkedIn, because I'm quite active there, active on Twitter. And I think I'm pretty easy to find on social channels once people start looking. and of course, I have my two books that you mentioned at the start of our conversation.
Available where books are sold.
And on Amazon. So, easy to find as well. Great. On all those online channels.
Well, Lena, thanks so much for being here. It's great to connect across the planet with you.
Oh, likewise, Heather. I've been a fan for a long time, so it's lovely to be able to speak.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for having me on your show.
And thank you for listening to the Influence Change at Work show. If you'd like to find more resources to help you influence change in your organization, including individual coaching, team workshops, and upcoming training events, please visit inclaria.com. While you're there, be sure to click in the box in the upper right-hand corner to access a free course about applying 5 drivers to influence change at work. Until next time, best wishes for making a bigger impact.